might slip, you might slide, you might stumble and fall by the roadside. But don't you ever let nobody drag your spirit down. Remember you're walking up the heaven. Don't let nobody turn you around. Walk with the rich, walk with the poor. Learn from everyone, that's what life is for. And don't you let nobody drag your spirit down. Remember you're walking up to heaven. Don't let nobody turn you around.
That's acoustic blues singer Eric Bibb with Don't Let Nobody Drag Your Spirit Down. Amen to that. It's from his 2005 album, Painting Signs. If the name Bibb sounds familiar to you, it's because Eric Bibb is the son of folk singer and musical theater performer Leon Bibb. He was born in New York City, but now lives in Finland. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. About 40,000 workers are voting this week on whether to ratify a new four-year contract that their union, the United Auto Workers, has worked out with Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. All eyes in the auto industry are looking for the outcome, which might predict how contract negotiations with General Motors and Ford Motor Company. The industry employs some 141,000 people. Two longtime union workers are with us today to discuss their concerns about the contract negotiation process, the concessions they say the UAW appears to have made, the definitive change in workers' rights and benefits, and, of course, the number one thing, a two-tier pay system and the outsourcing of jobs. Alex Wassell is with UAW Local 869, and he has been working in Warren since 1997 at a stamping facility there. We'll get to know what stamping is. And Melvin Thompson is with UAW Local 140, which has more than 3,000 members, also in Warren, Michigan. He is working at the truck assembly plant there. So I welcome both of you, Alex and Melvin, to Lead Stories today.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with you, Alex. Voting has begun, but we're hearing already concerns that the UAW seems to be rushing things and rushing this vote. Are you of that opinion?
Yes, I do believe that they're rushing the vote, and they're not allowing enough time for complete inspection of the contract and informed discussion and an informed vote.
What makes you say that they are rushing this this vote, and what indications have you had about that?
Well, basically, at the truck plant next door, which Melvin is a member of, they had their informational meeting, I believe, yesterday and today, and they're voting consecutively with the informational meeting. The members haven't had the contract in their hands since last week, late last week. And not enough time has been allowed for discussion.
Melvin, are you of the same mind that there seems to be a rush to this vote to ratify this contract?
Well, the contract is a massive endeavor to understand, and we do need some time. There's always an element of trust with your UAW. They give us highlights, and most members actually make their decision based on the highlights. Most members don't read the entire contract, but for those that do, they offer insight to other members on issues that members think are really important. So you need time to have that exchange sometimes between members, not just between the leadership and the membership, but between the membership and itself.
So I have to ask a follow-up question here. You're suggesting, and I'm hearing it in what Alex is also saying, that there's some kind of distrust with the union and its members. Is that what I'm reading? Is that a correct reading of what it is you're saying, both saying?
I wouldn't agree to characterize it as distrust. I'm saying that there is always a level of trust that is necessary with such a complex contract. So the more people can understand, the more they can trust the things that they don't understand.
All right, let's begin with those things that you do understand, that you appear that you might be in favor of, elements of the contract as it exists, as you know it so far. What do you see in the contract that is of benefit to the UAW workers?
Well, I agree with the intent of everything that is in the contract, except for the outsourcing of some work. What I think most members are looking for is more of what they see in the contract. Many members feel that it is a concession contract because it doesn't keep up with the cost of living. When we used to get 3% raises, it was after cost of living was factored in, and you could actually call it a raise. So this contract has a complex way of giving you bonuses for achieving certain targets and metrics and whatnot. And people would just like a simpler way of being paid where they can understand their standard of living in relation to the previous year or the next year.
Alex, what of the contract that you've read so far, what do you find yourself in favor of?
Well, there is a basic wage increase for traditional or top or first tier workers. There is an increase in wages for second tier workers, although they now label them as in progression workers. But ultimately, We haven't given up the we haven't won back the concessions we've given up. There's still a two-tier wage scale, even though they call it in progression now. As far as a level of trust, in the 2011 agreement highlights, there was supposed to be a cap on the amount of two-tier workers, anything in excess of 25%, and I think Chrysler now employs roughly 42% lower-tier workers. They were supposed to be rolled automatically into top-tier wages at the end of this last contract. That didn't happen. So there's a lot of downsides of this contract. There's no cost of living, no return of cost of living. There's no basic increase in the pension benefits for current and future retirees. There's no rollover, or there's no rollover for second tier or in progression workers into top tier benefits like a defined pension plan. And by and large, there's a lot to not like about this agreement in my point of view.
Well, let's get to the two-tier issue, which was a sticking point during the negotiations. Could you explain what this two-tier system is and why, generally, workers were against it?
Well, traditionally, the union principle of equal pay for equal work has been abolished in the last couple of contracts. I mean, you and I would think it would be terrible if I gave you less pay for being a woman versus a man. Your sexual orientation was different. Your religion was different. You would get different pay levels based on that. Well, what we're doing now is giving different payments to people based on their date of entry into Chrysler or FCA. And that is definitely unfair, wrong, and should go away.
The two-tier system had workers from, this is according to this 2007 contract, one group of workers who were employed at or before that time would have a particular rate of pay, and workers hired after that would have a lower rate of pay. That's basically the two-tier system. Why would you be against that? Why is the union against it when the argument was made, look, it's better to have something than nothing? And the auto industry at the time was reeling. It was threatening to shut down plants and get out of town. And in a sense, the two-tier system was itself a concession by the union to accommodate the auto industry, and ushering in this two-tier system was the way they did that. Melvin, what are your thoughts?
Prior to the two-tier being ushered in, members knew that the car companies were in trouble, and we had made concessions before. And the talk on the floor was people trying to estimate what dollar an hour amount could they give up. You know, I can give up three, but not four. I could give up five, but not six. You know, we knew that we were going to give concessions. We all appreciate these jobs and want to keep these jobs and want to keep the company viable. But we did not design the two-tier that we were presented with. That was presented to us in a situation where we virtually had to sign four concessions for our survival. But having done that, when the company is doing well, as they are now, we expect to go back to what we know is fair. If you do 100% of the job, you should get 100% of the money. It's not like there's an apprentice program. In 90 days, you know your job.
Is Chrysler, Fiat Chrysler, in a way, the test case for a radical and dramatic change in the nature of work in the auto industry?
I think the economy as a whole is not paying attention to the fact that its basic design is aggressive to workers. That is, we talk about it being a workerless recovery. It's not just the auto industry. Efficiencies are measured by how many humans can you get out of the system. We used to run by arbor hours. How many hours of man hours does it take to build this vehicle? The least it takes, the more efficient we are, the better it is for the company, which means the more people you get rid of, the better. And a society can't run devouring itself like that, not sustainably.
Alex Wassell, what are you thinking about this very question, about whether Fiat Chrysler and what is going on now, which is why everybody's watching what is going to be the result of the so-called ratification of this contract, and watching the plans that are afoot, including outsourcing and moving plants, which was one of the threats that the industry had made. Look, if you guys don't go along with our program, we just move everything out of here and see what happens then. What do you agree with Melvin Thompson, that this is essentially a worker, an anti-worker environment?
Well, I think it's an anti-worker environment throughout the U.S. and throughout the world these days. The more you hear about concern for the middle class and reports on the demise of the middle class, the less there are of the middle class. One might argue that temporary concessions when times were tough were justified, but times are great now for the auto industry, and they are not compensating the people that made the sacrifices. The auto industry sort of used to set the standard wages and benefit packages for the rest of the United States of America. So even though if you weren't a union member, if the guys at Ford, Chrysler, and GM got a raise, by and large, your employer would try to match that raise so you wouldn't jump ship, as it would say. And the society prospered. Everybody had money. We could pay taxes, pay for schools, hospitals, roads, and all that stuff. Well, that's gone away under these two-tier contracts and these concessionary contracts. We cannot, as a society, afford to continue down this road. It's wildly unpopular with the rank and file, and I know a lot of citizens across the world are feeling the pinch of reduced wages, benefits, and again, that's why Chrysler UAW or FCA UAW members are very much opposed to this agreement. I don't know how the final voting outcome will be, but I know there is a lot of dissatisfaction with what was presented.
From your own experience working at the stamping manufacturing plant out in Warren, how has life changed for you as an auto industry worker?
Okay, I'm working an alternate work schedule, which is much hated at my plant and throughout the system. So I work, my life has changed because now I work Monday and Tuesdays afternoon shifts from 4 in the afternoon till 2:30 in the morning. Today, Wednesday and Thursdays are my new weekends. Then I work Friday and Saturday from 5:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. So the swing shift is very detrimental to my health specifically and everybody's at the plant in general. I haven't seen a pay raise in base pay in a long time, and with no cost of living. People are forced to work more overtime if they want to stay at a certain lifestyle, or you fall back if you can only work your 40 hours. So life has definitely changed for me. It's definitely changed for a lot of folks on the shop floor, and I don't know if the UAW leadership understands this fully. And that's why there's a lot of dissatisfaction with this tentative agreement.
And yet you say, while your life has changed so dramatically, and not in a good way, the manufacturer for whom you work is doing very, very well. How is your life compared to how the company is doing financially?
Well, in the old days, when the company did well, you did well. These days, they sort of decoupled that formula. So when the company's doing great, you still may be hurting. And since I'm a traditional worker, I'm on the high end of the pay scale. I'm getting by. My wife works, so with two incomes, I'm still okay. But for those folks that hired in on a second tier level, they're having a rough time, and I think a lot of people can't afford to buy the products they build, which is a shame.
Melvin Thompson, the product you help build is trucks, and trucks are supposed to be doing very, very well. The sales of trucks, in fact, have increased, but yet we are hearing that one of the negotiating points would be to outsource the manufacturing of some trucks to Mexico and other places and increase a new product line. That should be music to your ears, is it?
I don't know if they're outsourcing a truck. The truck is going to a different plant that can build more vehicles. And while we can understand a company wanting to maximize its vehicles at appropriate facilities, part of that plan involves moving some cars to Mexico, we believe. I don't know. And we definitely have a problem with that. I work the same shift as Alex, give or take a half hour here or there. And the pressure on the floor is unbelievable. 10-hour shifts put an added pressure on you. Working a swing shift is basically sleep deprivation that no human being can compensate for. And so when you have good times and there's still a squeeze on, there's just a feeling of anguish on the shop floor that will this ever get better? Will we ever get over the hump? And all we want is some very basic things like the ability to keep up with the cost of living while the company is profiting. We don't think that is an unreasonable request.
In what ways did the company play hardball, in your view, during labor negotiations?
That is the 1,000-pound gorilla that the membership doesn't get a chance to see, which is why we may argue with our leadership, but understand that they may see things that we don't see. We don't know what might have been outsourced, even though we have a problem with what wound up being outsourced. And that's why I say there's always a level of trust between membership and leadership on these contract issues. But the more they can clarify for us, the better. And when Alex says we feel that this is not enough time to understand things, a lot of members feel that way.
Alex, I ask you the same question. In what ways would you say the company has played hardball here and extracted concessions from the union?
They extracted concessions long ago. They're just maintaining those concessions. Obviously, two-tier wage and benefit packages is a major concession. If you're working alternate work schedules and you're doing away with time and a half after 8 hours and time and a half on Saturday, it's a concession. They're talking about forming a health care co-op, which may turn to be another concession, because if costs aren't contained, guess who's going to pay the difference? It'll be the workers. They still maintain a draconian attendance policy where after a certain amount of tardies in a year, you're liable to get fired. I mean, and we're talking, you know, minimal number. You know, if you're tardy six times in a year, you're on the road to nowhere quick. So in other industries, you know, if you miss once every 2 months, you're going to be employee of the year. Here it's a different story. We've jettisoned the union principles of equal pay for equal work. We've jettisoned the principle of the 8-hour day and overtime pay. And I don't see good things happening with this contract. Are there minor improvements? Maybe, but Melvin's plan is losing the pickup truck. They're going to get what looks to be a high-priced, low-volume sports utility, and that might mean job loss for them. I'm guessing it will. Will the workers be allowed to follow their work? Will there be some sort of provisions to help them out in this contract? I haven't seen anything spelled out yet. So here we are. We're still waiting to to finish the ratification procedure. I don't know how it's going to shake out. I think Chrysler was picked as a target because if they go to Ford and GM, the packages will definitely better than what we're seeing at Chrysler. So it's easier to sell a contract not knowing that the other guys got a better deal than you did.
Is there a sense of a connection between what the UAW is doing here in the United States and what is happening to workers outside of the United States employed by the same companies? Is there some kind of connection or some way in which the contract, as negotiated, recognizes that the union also should be concerned about what's happening with workers outside of the United States? When a U.S. worker loses a job or finds that the job conditions are pared down in such a way, as you and Melvin have been saying, about trying to make ends meet, and yet outside of the United States, in other plants connected to the same employer, you have people who are paid even, I mean, just ridiculously low wages. But is the union negotiation process cognizant of these things?
The UAW is definitely aware of that. I work with a group called a Soldier Call. They're injured workers that were unjustly fired in Columbia at a General Motors plant. And the workers around the world that work for these companies have what we sometimes call yellow unions or company unions. The work pace is just abusive. And so it turns out that the companies that we work for can threaten us with the same abuse. If they're abusing them at a level 10 and they're abusing us at a level 4, they say, well, you better let us turn it up to 5 or we'll just send it all down there because we can abuse them at a level 10. I know that's an ugly way to put it, but if you understood what these workers go through with the excessive hours, the extreme rate of work and the low pay, there's no way that we can maintain our standard of living without working on the standard of living of workers around the world.
Well, by the 28th, that is Monday, there ought to be some kind of a vote done. What do you expect will happen by then, Melvin Thompson?
I expect a vigorous debate. You know, I think that the leadership and the membership have to own their voice, have to listen to each other. And you almost never get everything in one contract, but what we have to have is a leadership that understands the membership.
And if you don't have a leadership that understands the membership, what is the membership, in your view, prepared to do?
Well, that usually happens in a progression. You know, right now the membership feel strong because they have produced. All we have heard is about month-over-month sales increases. You know, the company wanted to go public. They did. Their IPO took off. The stock price went up. We've done everything that we can do for this company, and still you turn around and tell us that we need, that these wealthy people need more money out of our pockets. I want to tie our money to the stock market.
Alex Wessel, the same question. Come Monday, there ought to be something of a vote. One, how do you expect the vote to go? And two, what will happen if, in fact, the workers say, okay, we go along? What does that say about the nature of work in your newly configured environment?
Well, our vote at Local 869 is, I believe, scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday. First of all, I want to tell you that Chrysler Skilled Trades workers in 2011 turned down the agreement. The International Executive Board ratified that regardless of our vote. The production workers narrowly approved that contract in 2011. So Chrysler workers speak their own minds, and we vote the way we want to, not the way people tell us. I think it'll be a close vote, but I think it'll be a no vote. If it is a no vote, we expect the bargainers to go back to the bargaining table and try to come back with a better contract. How that will go, I don't know. What are the workers' options if you're saddled with continued concession agreements? I'm not quite sure, but I think I would like the public to know that the workers on the shop floor are fairly savvy. They understand what a good contract looks like and what a bad contract looks like. And if they vote no, they expect something better. If they vote yes, it may not be a sign of approval, but it might be a sign of admission that these guys aren't going to get you anything better. So we can only wait and see. And I know how I'm voting, and I think I'd like to send them back to the bargaining table for a better agreement.
Thank you, Alex Wassell. Thank you, Melvin Thompson, for being with us today and giving us an update on this very, very important and significant event in the auto industry.
Well, thank you for having both of us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. We'll take this break and come back and talk about a fight in Chicago right after this.
Some say yes, some say no. Somewhere to see which way the wind blows. But don't you ever let nobody drag your spirit down. Well, we're walking up to heaven. Don't let nobody turn you around.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. It took a 34-day hunger strike by 15 activists to force Chicago Public Schools, that's the authority that regulates education in the city of Chicago, to reopen the historic Diet High School, D-Y-E-T-T High School, which was shut down last year. But the fight is just beginning, say our guests, who were strikers who envision the creation of the Diet Global Leadership and Green Technology High School. More than that, they also envision the rebirth of community control over education in the city of Chicago. And I just want to make one acknowledgement here. This story was actually brought to my attention by a Lead Stories, a Free Your Mind Friday listener, Henry from Chicago, who had called in and talked about this incredible victory won by the striking, hunger strikers, I should say, in the city of Chicago. We are joined by G2 Brown, who's the national director of the Journey for Justice Alliance, and Jeanette Taylor Rahman, a local school council member who also is a parent and a grandparent and has a long history of community organizing. But first, let's hear what was said, the concern of the community as this hunger strike continued and caused people in the community and throughout the city of Chicago to say, well, wait a minute, why do people have to go to such lengths to make a point? Here is a point about education. Here's Dr. Linda Ray Murray, who is a retired former chief medical officer for the Cook County Department of Public Health, voicing that concern as the hunger strike continued.
We're here as medical professionals to inform the public and to call on the mayor to take action immediately. Hunger striking is a very dangerous process and procedure. We have already had three of our hunger strikers need emergency medical attention. We know that others are at risk, and each day increases that medical risk of complications, even including possible death. So we want to impress on our city, and especially our mayor, that he needs to intervene immediately to sit down with these strikers, to have civil conversations with people that have the same interest that he claims to have, the education of our children. If this is not done, if this strike continues 11th, 12th, 13th day, the number of strikers, the number of people who are at risk for permanent damage increases every day. So we encourage our citizens to show support for this Diet Coalition, and we call on the mayor and Forrest Claypool to sit down with the strikers and begin to discuss the situation with them as though they were human beings.
Well, what an extraordinary thing that people found it necessary to put themselves in such danger. G2 Brown, who is the National Director of the Journey for Justice Alliance, thank you for joining us today. Jeanette, are you there with us?
I am. How are you doing?
Oh, fine. Thank you. Good to hear you now. This was an extraordinary thing to do. Why did you feel that it had to come, as one of the hunger strikers, why did it have to come to this point?
Because when you play by all the rules of the game, and you see your voice still being ignored, you come to the reality that the game is rigged. And so you're hearing about us going on a hunger strike, but you haven't heard that we've had six town hall meetings to discuss what diet the community wanted diet to become. You haven't heard that we've been working on a plan for the school since 2009. You haven't heard that a lot of us have went to jail on numerous occasions and gotten tickets and been banned from coming to CPS and City Hall over a neighborhood public high school. And so for us, the hunger strike was the last draw and kind of us being a part of the process and just trying to follow protocol. And so it was not an easy decision, but it was, we realized this is what we were going to have to do in order for Black parents and community members to get their voice heard.
Could you tell us a bit about Diet High School and why it is so significant in the community?
Diet High School sits in Washington Park. It may be the site of the Obama Library. It's in between Kenwood, Oakland, and Bronzeville. Bronzeville is the Black metropolis in Chicago. And so Diet High School has been really disserviced since probably 1999. It was a high-performing middle school that, because another school in the neighborhood was changing into a college prep, this school was destabilized from its very beginning. And so just imagine in a 3 months time being told that your high performing middle school is going to turn into a high school with no extra support. The school has seven books in the library. The first graduating class had no AP and honor classes. And so you're talking about a school that's been disinvested in from the very get-go, but because the community decided that we would invest in it and we would take up on the slack because these are our young people and this is our neighborhood to help it, every time that the school did something great or that the school overcame all of these obstacles, the district response was to deinvest it and really phase it out in 2012. And so that's the Diet story. You have a community who's helping to save a school while the district who gets paid and is charged to do right by the school and the young people weren't. And so this story didn't start with the hunger strike this year. This is something that's been happening since 2000. Diet was the receiving school for a lot of school closings in our neighborhood. And so it's never really ever gotten support it needed. And so this was a fight to say that we know what's best for our young people and that we're invested, the people in the community, parents and students are invested in making this school what it should be.
Jeetu Brown joins us now. He is the National Director of the Journey for Justice Alliance. Thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, the hunger strike is over, but as I said in the opening, this is just the beginning of the fight, in a way. What's the nature of the engagement now with the city of Chicago, specifically with Rahm Emanuel and the Chicago Public Schools?
Well, the first thing thanks for having me again. I think the first thing that we learned that became clear from this hunger strike is that there's no such thing as school choice. In black and brown communities, it's a farce. Over 4,800 people chose Walter Dyer Global Leadership at Green Technology High School. And while the mayor had the audacity to actually attend a ribbon cutting at Lincoln Elementary in wealthy Lincoln Park, not far from DePaul University, and award that community, that school a $21 million annex that they didn't even want, we starved just to have our voices heard in a district-ran neighborhood school. So I think what's next is that we have a state senator by the name of Kwame Raoul and Rainbow Push Coalition that is talking to the district on our behalf. We want to give the hunger strikers, we needed a few days just to recover and get out, you know, begin to feed ourselves again so we can get our energy. So we will be definitely turning the temperature up again around this issue to make sure that we are on the design team. And then there were a number of demands that we put in place. I want your listeners to understand there was never any negotiation. A compromise is when two people sit down at the table, they say what they want, and they reach an agreement that's mutually agreeable to both people. But to force an art school on a community when the arts is the number one industry that leads to unemployment, and then to reject green technology when that is the number one growth industry in our country, the question that people should be asking is, why not green technology? And the answer is simple. It's politics. It's a local alderman, Alderman Will Burns, who is an instrument for privatization. And he sees one of the members of the coalition, the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, as a political threat. So the mayor is allowing him to exclude us from the process. It's no more complicated than that. The proposal we submitted was by far the best out of the three, and it was vetoed from up top. When the internal review team said that our proposal was the best one. So I think what's next is in Chicago, we must have an elected representative school board. One of the things that is a common denominator in Chicago, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Detroit, Baltimore, in many other cities, Philadelphia, Camden, New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey, in all of those cities, is that we don't have voting rights. We cannot remove board members when they make bad policy, even though they can raise our taxes. And another common denominator in all those cities is that these are places where the majority of the children serve are African American or Latino. Now, you don't have appointed school boards in the hills of West Virginia. You don't have them in suburbia. You don't have them in rural Tennessee. We have plenty of poor white folk. But but you do have them in the cities I mentioned, as if us having a right to vote is why the schools have struggled. And another thing, a point we just like to make, is that there is no such thing as failing schools. We have been failed. Our trust has been betrayed. We pay taxes, and we have a reasonable expectation that, the school system should provide the same quality of education for our children as they do in more affluent areas. But that is just not the case. And I don't mean city and suburbs. I mean within the same city across this country, you see the disparities. If you go to New Orleans in the Lower Ninth Ward, half of that city is still not functioning. You still have entire blocks where they're just steps where the houses used to be. You have neighborhoods with no schools. As soon as you cross the street into St. Bernard Parish, which is a working class white town where a lot of the folks, you know, work on the docks, they basically have a brand new city. They have a brand new school. They have a K through 12 school. Well, half the one side of the street is K through 8, and the other half of the street is 9 through 12. That was built after Hurricane Katrina. And those children in that parish have the right to attend that school because of where they live. So I think one of the things that came from this hunger strike is lifting up the savage inequities that exist. Again, there is no such thing as school choice. It's a farce. And
I have to ask you about this fight, this struggle. Could you place it in the context of what appears to be the intent not only of the local administration, Rahm Emanuel's administration of shutting down schools, but also the irony that the nation's education secretary comes from Chicago. The president of the United States comes from Chicago. Could you give us an idea of how diet and the shutting down of diet fits into this national plan of just shutting down schools as a precursor to communities that are to be turned over for a more, quote, desirable population?
Yes, ma'am. I think that's an excellent question. Well, people should know that Dyett High School is about 3.5 blocks from the president's home. Arnie Duncan basically cut his teeth in youth development in Bronzeville. He mentored students at Rabbis Elementary School, which is about 4 blocks from Dyett High School. His mother, for decades, ran an after-school program in Bronzeville at Jackie Robinson Elementary School. And the program that is going across the country started in Chicago. They've been closing schools in Chicago as early as 1998, as Chicago Housing Authority began to tear down many of the buildings. But as an organized program that was aware to the public in 2003-2004. And they started in Bronzeville. The first wave of what was Renaissance 2010 started in our neighborhood, and it was to close 20 out of the 22 schools. In our community and turned them into either charter, contract, or CPS performing schools. And, of course, our president, unfortunately, supported that agenda and nationalized it through Race to the Top. Arnie Duncan was the friendly face that can spread that gospel all over the country. And that's what he's done. And so through mandating that the only way that struggling schools can get resources is if they either closed their school, turned it around, made it a charter, or a reconstitution. All 4 of those are punitive, top-down corporate education interventions. Then it inspired school closings all over the country. That's why they're closing schools in Wichita. That's why they're closing schools in Boston. That's why they're closing schools in Eupora, Mississippi. Places that you wouldn't dream that you would see school closings. Dayton, Ohio, you are. Because the only way that those struggling school districts can have access to federal funds is by adhering to, you know, those guidelines, which is why we fought and won what's called the fifth option. So now you can use federal funds for community schools, and that's what we're trying to encourage communities to do around the country, is to fight for sustainable community schools. I mean, there's no example of a city where privatization has worked over any type of protracted period of time, not one. In New Orleans, up until 2012, it's 79% of the schools that it replaced, the public schools after Hurricane Katrina, received a D or F grade on a state exam. So they cooked the books in the last year and a half to make the schools look better. But nobody's fooled by that. But in Cincinnati, since 2003, as they started community schools, or what they call community learning centers, in 2003, the graduation rate was at about 54%. Now it's at about 83%. The opportunity gap between black and white children was well over 20%. Now it's at about 3%. They only have four schools in the entire city on the academic watch list. So over a decade period of time, we can look at this particular approach and see that it works. But at the end of the day, it's not about what works. And I think that's what people need to understand. This is about racism, and it's about greed. It's about
Jeanette
racism.
Taylor Rahman, I want to ask you, as we come to a close of the program here, you're a local school council member and a hunger striker. One could kind of garner from that alone that you are, in fact, involved in a battle even on the inside. Tell us about that. Are you there? Oh, did we lose Jeanette? Not having very good luck with our phones today. Jeanette Taylor, are you there? Well, let me ask you the question then, G2 Brown. This would suggest that the fight is also on the inside, where Jeanette Taylor Rahman, one of the hunger strikers, is a local school council member. One would expect, because of her participation in the strike, it suggests that there's a fight also on the inside.
Well, I wouldn't qualify it as in. Oh, there she is.
She's there. There she is.
Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm. I've been on the local school council since I was 19, and I'm 40. And so I've always tried to fight to make sure that young people in my school and my community get the resources that they need and that they deserve. And so it's only fitting I was on the hunger strike because I've been a part of the process. I haven't been a disengaged parent. I haven't been a parent who hasn't attended meeting after meeting after meeting. I hadn't been a parent who was at the school closing meetings crying and begging them not to close my schools but to support my school. And so it's the same monster who says that my kids are not worthy. It's the same monster who tells me that I'm not worthy as a black mother to have my voice heard at the table. And so me being a part of the hunger strike was not a heavy lift for me. It's something that I vowed that I would always support and help the kids in my community. And this is a way of showing them. We always say this generation is lost. No, this generation has been neglected. And it's because the policies in place are put there not to educate children, but to make money. And so
how can people help this struggle?
Well, I think we are looking at the next phase. What Chicago Public Schools has done is try to make sure that we had no involvement in the development of the new diet. That school would not be open without us. We're the ones that drive the tears of those students when their civil rights were being violated, when they had to go through the back door of their school or they didn't have any honors or AP classes. I think what people can do is they can call 773-548-7500 if they're interested in just what the next steps are regard to the hunger strike. They can ask for me. They can ask for Jeribu Lee. Another thing is that you can call 773-744-3300, call Mayor Rahm Emanuel and tell him that it is unconscionable that the people that saved the school are not involved on the design team, and he should support green technology in the curriculum and put the Coalition of Revitalized Diet on the design team. So that is... you all will be hearing more about that in the next couple of weeks in regards to just an organized effort. But I think those are some very tangible ways where people can help.
Well, thank you for being with us today and giving us this beginning of an insight into the struggle. We certainly will be following it up. Thank you, Jeetu Brown and Jeanette Taylor-Rahman, talking about diet, global leadership, and Green Technology High School. I'm calling it, I'm willing it, I'm envisioning it as the new and revitalized Diet High School. Thank you so much for being with us today. And that brings us to the end of our program. I hope it was insightful. I hope you got something out of it. Keep it right here at prn.fm. The NDC Savings Club is next. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.